From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the concluding segment in a two-part discussion about modern American presidential history and politics, with attention to the political legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The panelists are three social historians: William Luchtenberg, Otis Graham, and David McCullough. William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham are professors at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. William Luchtenberg's book, In the Shadow of FDR, was a main selection of the History Book Club. Otis Graham's book, Toward a Planned Society, traces American social and economic patterns between the presidencies of FDR and Richard Nixon. David McCullough is at work on a forthcoming biography of FDR's successor, Harry S. Truman. David McCullough is the author of Mornings on Horseback and The Great Bridge, social histories about Theodore Roosevelt and the Brooklyn Bridge. The Path Between the Seas, David McCullough's history of the creation of the Panama Canal, won the National Book Award. The discussion for Soundings begins with comments by David McCullough about the nature of American presidential influence.
Well, I think probably I would think most about the level of expectancy that a president creates. And certainly with a man like FDR, it was very, very high. If the presidency is a focal point for the emotional level of the country, for the ambition of the country, for the anxiety of the country, then if he's a conduit of all of those feelings, then Roosevelt was the greatest of all conduits for our century. And certainly one of the very most important factors you have to take into consideration when thinking about Harry Truman, always have to take into consideration, is who was the man he followed. I asked a man who was on Roosevelt's staff what it was like the next morning when Truman came in to the White House, came into the Oval Office. And I think I phrased it, what impressed you most? And he said, speaking of Harry Truman, he could walk. And I think it's a marvelous moment because, for one thing, it shows how, for those who are living and working there, it's the humanity of the individual, the fact that the president is, after all, a person, that makes the strongest impression.
Would it be fair to say that, just a kind of a footnote here about the way presidents get treated by the broadcasters and the newspaper people, would it be fair to say that he was given special treatment because of his disability, Bill Luchtenberg?
Well, not special treatment in the sense of being sympathetic to his condition and treating him easier. But what is true is that there was a broad conspiracy not to show pictures of Franklin Roosevelt as a crippled man.
Otis Graham, did you have a comment?
There's much that I found in the Truman presidency from reading Bill's chapter, and I thought I knew the Truman presidency reasonably well. One could cite many things. But I liked especially, Bill, I read that chapter for the second time last night, the way that Truman at the end, after having struggled for, 7 years with the widespread and publicly stated notion that he was unsatisfactory and quite a comedown, was departing from the tradition and all the rest of it. Whereas Truman had a certain pride, possibly justified pride, in his own program, which in some cases went beyond FDR's and in his own efforts and the rest. He said at the end, at least at the end of Bill's chapter, and I think at the end of his presidency, great men know when to die. I hadn't known Truman said that, but it was Truman's way of saying something that's that's a profound insight into how to become a great man. That's one of the things that is etched clearly when you watch Bill trace the way Truman and the others struggled with that legacy.
I think one of the interesting points that Otis has just raised here about Truman, and maybe you could say this about all successful politicians, is that, and this is something I don't think you would normally give Truman credit for, is that he had a great sense of theater. He knew when to come on stage, when to go off stage. He knew instinctively, for example, that the feisty, chipper, Middle Western, straight from the shoulder candidate of the 48 campaign was the guy who might beat Tom Dewey. Whereas there were two or three other Harry Trumans, just as real as the Harry Truman that was out there campaigning against Dewey, who would have lost to Dewey. Now, that's a sense of theater. That's a sense of political instinct. It's a political instinct, which is very, very important. Truman was a much more complicated, much more interesting fellow than I think he's been given credit for. And he was not he wasn't a little nobody when he became president, which is one of the more unfortunate misconceptions about him, it seems to me. And one of the points I think ought to be made in Franklin Roosevelt's Franklin Roosevelt's great credit is he saw that. Otherwise, he would not have gone along with Truman as his running mate. It's too glib and too easy to simply say, "Oh, we picked him because he was a compromise candidate."
But David,
lots of other people could have been.
It's hard to defend Roosevelt's treatment and handling of Truman as vice president. It's very hard, and Truman's resentment of that is a proper resentment of a citizen, I would say.
Well, I think you're right, but I think also there's undoubtedly a personal explanation for that. If you are Franklin Roosevelt, and you have strong intimations of your own mortality, and if everybody around you is worried about that, and either for the show that you would be making publicly or for the show that you would be making internally within the family of the White House to be, start bringing Harry Truman around an awful lot, which was not the tradition up to that point, would be a real tip-off, not only to those around you, but to yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that could possibly be part of the explanation.
I know I haven't heard that before. That does make a good deal of sense. I have a different view, which I can't document. And that is that Franklin Roosevelt never believed he was going to die.
Both those views could be true. Both could be true.
There were lots who would have agreed with him.
That's right. That's right.
Let me put a couple of questions to Bill Luchtenberg. First of all, following up what David McCullough and Otis Graham have been talking about, how did FDR treat Truman as a vice president? They've talked about this in sort of outline form. And then subsequent to that treatment, what were the really substantive, were there substantive political differences in the way Truman handled the presidency following FDR's death?
Well, on the first point, Truman saw FDR in any real sense probably no more than twice during the period that he was Vice President of the United States.
You mean actually sat and talked with
him? Actually sat and talked to him. Now, we have to remember, we're talking about a very short period of time. He actually takes office only in January of 45, and FDR dies in April. So we're talking about only a few months. Nonetheless, he had no briefing at all about what the responsibilities were he's about to take on. One significant indication of this, not directly involving FDR, but one of FDR's appointees, is that at the end of the first cabinet meeting, Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, asks the president to step aside so that he can tell him a little bit, just a few hints about the fact that there is something going on called the atomic bomb. And even then, Stimson did not feel that he could confide to the President of the United States everything about it. And it wasn't for a couple more weeks that he knew what the Manhattan Project was. That's how ill-prepared he was by FDR and people around him.
Just to interrupt one second, when you think that over 500,000 people were involved with the Manhattan Project, 500,000 people, and the Vice President of the United States didn't even know of its existence. What an incredible security success that was.
They asked one worker.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, they asked one worker down in Oak Ridge what he was making there, and he said $1.35 an hour.
What about politics and FDR and Truman, Bill? How did they differ? What, for instance, did Truman do politically that was noticeably different from what FDR had been doing?
Well, when he took office, one of the early things he did in September of 1945 was to deliver a 21-point message that spelled out all that the New Deal had been doing and hoped to do. And through all of that first term, Truman acted as though he was simply carrying out FDR's fourth term, that he was a caretaker president. In his own mind, he was not diverging from FDR whatsoever. In fact, there are ways in which Truman's policies were more moderate or more conservative than FDR's. He was much more impatient with organized labor. And there were times that he contemplated even drafting railway workers into the army in order to break strikes. Within a year of his taking office, all of the Roosevelt cabinet officers were gone. And some of those he named in place were men of more moderate conservative orientation. In general, Truman went down the line for many of the same objectives as FDR. He too wanted a decent society, and he favored specific programs like minimum wage laws. But he was distrustful of the New Dealers, distrustful of the notion of remaking society in the fashion that some of the New Deal visionaries wanted to do.
I think it's important to remember, in addition, that he didn't have Roosevelt's feel for conservation, though he was officially committed, certainly to large public works and Waterfield. He didn't have Roosevelt's commitment to planning, never understood the planning potentialities, limited though they are, of the 1946 Employment Act. And in foreign relations, I've always been struck with something which is elusive to deal with, but I think could be stated in this way fairly. Their attitude toward communism was very different, discernibly different, and with great effect, I think. While one can't speak glibly about Roosevelt's relationship to communism, and they lived in different times and they were facing a different communism and a different world configuration, still, Roosevelt felt that there was a difference between communism and fascism, and he reserved his own special distaste for fascism. He didn't see communism as domestically or internationally in the different circumstances of the 30s as anything like this sort of threat. Truman had a sense that fascism and communism were birds of the same feather, and perhaps communism was perhaps to be detested even more.
I don't know if this is just my own irrational musing, but it seems to me that in many ways our present-day world begins with Harry Truman, and that something that is not our present-day world to a certain extent ended with Roosevelt. When you think that Truman, what Truman created, that we're still living with, the bomb obviously being the most dramatic and upstages everything else, the CIA, the National Security Council, the establishment of Israel, the whole rejuvenation of Europe with a Marshall Plan, the idea that we can move into another part of the world and stop or draw the line on the expansion of communism in Korea, that the strong movements toward the desegregation of our society, the use of television, which begins with Harry Truman. Mm-hmm. He's our first TV president, for example, and not a very good one in that respect. All of this is so modern in a way, and we see these things in the papers every day.
You're persuasive about that, David, and yet as I think about it, most of those things were in place by 1942. I'd tend to push back that sense of modernity's beginnings into the war years, but it's an interesting problem.
Now, perhaps because I've written a book on the New Deal, whereas you fellows are writing about other subjects, I'd push it back still a little bit further.
Yeah.
As if you were to walk into any American town in 1932, you'd have no sign of a federal presence. There are no public housing projects to be seen. There's no old age
insurance. That's a wonderful
image. No unemployment compensation.
And most people aren't paying federal taxes directly.
Most people are not paying federal
taxes.
But
all you had was the post office.
The post office is about
all
you see. Yeah. And if you go into a town today and you see a post office, it's odds are that it was built in the New Deal. So I think I think of the modern age as starting with FDR and the New Deal, though certainly it's true that there's a great deal that Truman adds to it. And probably young people today would find themselves more struck by a sense of familiarity with the world of Harry Truman than with the world of FDR.
I every time I see Truman in an old newsreel, I just am so struck by the difference between that approach, that style, that manner in front of the microphone or the camera, we have become so accustomed to these very skillfully sandpapered, clothed, packaged politicians to see Truman just belting it out.
Well, David, he was spared. He
so
was,
refreshing.
He was spared an influence which has distorted the presentation of all the others after him. He didn't have to go to college or law school.
Well, you know, I think there's a paradox in what you're saying, David, because you've been presenting him as the first president of the modern era, and at the same time, you say quite rightly that what we think of as being his main characteristic is a simplicity, a sincerity, which is unlike that of the modern era.
He is a 19th century American, which is why I'm so drawn to him. He was a man who, for example, hated the telephone. One of the reasons we have so many marvelous Harry Truman letters is that he much preferred to write a letter to using the telephone. He would never tolerate air conditioning. And in fact, when he had guests come to the White House, they would convince him that they ought to crank up the air conditioning about a half an hour before somebody was due to arrive so that they wouldn't be uncomfortable when they walked into the president's office, because he didn't want any air conditioning. And all of his attitudes, his the old sort of ground root American ethic, that you paid your bills, that you kept your word, that you worked hard, all of those sort of very simple but very strong sense of right and wrong that he had, is so purely 19th century. I was talking with one of his in-laws, who were very shy about any attribution and so forth. But in any event, a man who knew Harry Truman very, very well, all of his life, a very close relation of his. And we'd talked at some length, and I said, if you had to describe the man you knew, not the President of the United States, but the man you knew all your life, whose name was Harry Truman, and you had to describe him, how would you do it? What would you say? And there was this long pause while he thought, and he said, complicated.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the concluding segment in a two-part discussion about modern American presidential history and politics. The panelists are three social historians: David McCullough, William Luchtenberg, and Otis Graham. William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham are professors at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Otis Graham is the author of Toward a Planned Society, a book that traces American social and economic growth from FDR to Richard Nixon. William Luchtenberg's most recent book is In the Shadow of FDR, A Study of Presidential Influence. David McCullough's book about the Panama Canal, The Path Between the Seas, won the National Book Award. David McCullough is now at work on a forthcoming biography of Harry S. Truman. Here is William Luchtenberg.
I think one aspect of the complication is that though he appears to be this simple man of 19th century verities, he is at the same time a man who is able to grow to meet the demands of the post-war world, and I think particularly in the field of civil rights, that you say, that that's going to be the area, perhaps more than any other in the domestic field, that's going to distinguish him from FDR in the place of history. Not that FDR was a man of racial bias, and indeed FDR's contributions to the growth of rights of black Americans, I think, has been underestimated. But there was no civil rights legislation enacted under FDR or strongly advocated. And here you have Truman, a man who was raised in a home of Confederate sympathizers. When he became president, he said to his mother that if she'd come to the White House, he'd make it possible for her to sleep in Lincoln's bed. And she said, if that's the best you can do, I'll sleep on the floor. A man coming out of that background, who becomes the first American president to establish a civil rights commission, in good part out of a sense of personal shock at the terrible lynchings that had just occurred, and who is willing not to go along as far as a number of people on his own committee would like him to have gone, but nonetheless is willing to take a strong enough stand so that his party is divided, and the Dixiecrats walk out of the party, and for a time it seems a doom is hoped for re-election. His taking that forthright a stand on civil rights then, and then going on to make important strides toward the desegregation of the armed forces, that's probably the single most significant aspect of Truman's domestic policy to lay his claim to history.
You have been talking, David McCullough, Otis Graham, Bill Luchtenberg, about the connections between FDR and Truman. And at one point earlier in our discussion, David McCullough pointed out that that the popular conception of Truman is unfair, that he knew a lot more. He was more complicated, I think is the word that one of your sources used to describe him. Reflect for me on how did he know these things? If you were to paint in broad strokes the sorts of influences that you as presidential historians look at when you're describing FDR and Truman, who did they read? What kinds of ideas did they have? David McCullough talked about Truman as somebody who was probably more learned. I don't know if that was your word, but more widely read than people give him credit for being.
Well, he was of the old-fashioned, and that doesn't necessarily mean unsound, of the old-fashioned idea that history is biography. And he adored biography. He read biography at every opportunity. I asked Margaret Truman, what would your father's idea of heaven have been? And she said, a comfortable chair, a good light, and a stack of three or four books of history and biography that he hadn't yet touched. And he had studied the lives of great men, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, Lincoln. Those were his heroes, his subjects. And he had great wide-ranging interest in history, European history, Roman history, classical history. His life was a consistent pattern of disappointments which he overcame, setbacks, big ones. Wanted to go to West Point, couldn't get in because of his eyes. Wanted to be a banker. Was told by his father he had to quit his job in the Kansas City Bank and come back and work on the farm because they were in trouble. Wound up as a farmer for 11 years of his life. Didn't like the farm. The great change in his life came with the First World War, as it did for many people, many lives. He never went back to the farm. He never went back to rural life of any kind or working with his hands in any way after the war. And he was a great success in the war. He was an extremely able, courageous, and popular officer in combat. He is one of the very few presidents of our time who has known what it was to be in a war. He came home with a following, his regiment, Battery D, and that inspired him to go into politics after he had failed as a haberdasher in Kansas City, which it should be understood was to which there was no shame attached, as there would be later when it was broadcast that he couldn't even be a success as a haberdasher. There was no shame because an advance shockwave of the Depression had hit the Middle West, and retail businesses were going out of business rapidly. So everybody understood it, and nobody blamed him particularly locally. What was more interesting to people locally was how he handled this failure, which was to pay back all of his debts for years. He was still paying back his old haberdashery debts when he was in the Senate and when he was finding it very difficult to live on his salary as a senator in Washington. And once he got reelected, he became quite a senator. And he initiated and was the chairman of a very important, very interesting committee, the Truman Committee, as it became known, which was designed, set up to look into cheating, profiteering, inefficiency in the war effort. Mainly to oversee how the Pentagon was spending its money. And I would like on this program to be the first to suggest that that committee ought to be reinstated. We ought to have a committee right now like that.
Well, what's the difference between that and the Grace Commission, for instance?
Well, this one had lots of power and lots of public and popular and press support. And it had Harry Truman running it. And he was very fair, tenacious, and effective, and he became overnight a very well-known, highly regarded senator. the journalists in Washington took a poll of who had been the 10 civilians who had done the most for the war effort after the war was over, or toward the end of the war. And the only member of Congress, the only member of either body of the Congress, the Senate or the House, to be listed among those 10 men was Harry Truman.
Isn't it true, David, that just to jump in, the Grace Commission looked all around the government, but not terribly hard at the military, more at welfare fraud and paper shuffling. The Truman Committee looked at the military, which is where the money then was and is now being spent in the greatest volume.
Exactly, and they looked at the corporations. They sent people to jail. They sent executives of very large, powerful corporations to prison, and it had teeth.
And one aspect of this, I think, that ties into what you were saying before, David, is that Truman, as he carried on this important work as the head of the Truman Committee, drew upon his knowledge of history and his reading. And he looked very closely at the Committee of 15 and the Civil War. He wanted to be sure that on the one hand, this was a useful congressional committee, and on the other hand,
it did not in any way impede
Franklin Roosevelt as Commander-in-Chief of the United States in the prosecution of the war.
Truman... this is an old theme, and one that we could spend another several hours talking about. Truman's family influence, his childhood influence. One thing that Truman and FDR certainly had in common is they were both the sons of very strong women. Women who saw those sons as being somebody special. Now, they were not, in my view, like, say, the mother of Lyndon Johnson, who really wanted Lyndon Johnson to fulfill her own frustrated feelings about her own life, her own lack of success, or the lack of success that her husband had brought into the family. Truman's mother had a wonderful sense of humor. She had a wonderful sense of right and wrong. She was even more decided in her opinions and more. Saw the world even in even more sharply defined shades of white, black and white than her son did. A tramp came to the back door of the Truman House one day when Mama Truman was nearly 70 years old and asked for some food, and she fixed him a plate and a cup of coffee and brought it out onto the porch. And he took a taste of the coffee and said, "This is cold," and handed it back to her. And she went back into the house and came back out onto the porch with a shotgun. And she said, "You get going or I'll warm more for you than just your coffee." Now that has a lot to do with the way Harry Truman was.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a two-part discussion about modern American presidential history and politics. The panelists were three social historians, William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham of the University of North Carolina, and David McCullough. Next week on Soundings, the first segment in a series of discussions about women's literary studies. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the second of two discussions about modern American presidential politics. Historians of the modern American presidency have written about the age of FDR. How far does Franklin Roosevelt's influence extend into contemporary presidential politics? What's the nature of FDR's influence, and how do social historians measure it? The panelists for Soundings include presidential historians William Luchtenberg and Otis Graham of the University of North Carolina, and David McCullough, the author of a forthcoming biography of Harry Truman. In the Shadow of FDR, Part 2, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.